This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your lone co-host this week, Ethan Frisch, and my guests are people I've known for quite a while in this funny food startup space that we all seem to float around in and run into each other at trade shows and ask each other for advice and share contacts. Carolyn Cotto and Claire Schlemme are the co-founders of Renewal Mill based in Oakland, California. Carolyn, Claire, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us. Ethan.
So let's kick it off with a little bit of an introduction. What is Renewal Mill and how did the two of you come to start the company?
Sure. Yeah. So Renewal Mill is an upcycled food company. We are fighting climate change and global food loss by upcycling byproducts from food manufacturing into superfood ingredients and premium products, including baking mixes and cookies. I got started in this space from my previous venture, which was a juice company. So this was back probably about 7 or 8 years now. And that it was through that experience that I came face to face with food waste and realized that there's a lot of inefficiencies in food production. So as you can imagine, if you've ever juiced before, you know, we would end each day with just these mountains of fruit and vegetable pulp. And we really struggled with that because we knew there was something better that we could be doing with it. It was, you know, premium organic fruits and vegetables that we were buying. So, you know, there was an economic component to it too. And then of course, as we wasted all of this, as we wasted all of the pulp, we were also wasting all of those resources that had gone into growing the fruits and vegetables to begin with. So, you know, it was definitely something that was weighing on my mind. And when I was looking for new opportunities in the sustainability, kind of the intersection between sustainability and food, that byproduct idea just kept kind of coming to the surface. And I kept thinking about it. And I ended up meeting the owner of a tofu factory based in Oakland. And we immediately bonded over this byproduct issue because he had one as well. It was very similar to what I had seen with the juice. It's essentially the first step in making tofu is making soy milk. And that's kind of like milking the soybeans to get that soy milk. And you have a lot of pulp that's left over and it's highly nutritious. There's a lot of really cool stuff with it. But there's no real place for it to go. And so it's treated as a waste product. And what made it really exciting was that, you know, we struggled in the juice business with our byproduct because we were pretty small, but here you have someone that's doing food production. So they're relatively, large volumes that they're producing. And so it was an interesting opportunity.
What were some of those quantities, early on? Like how much soybean pulp were you kind of tasked with finding a home for?
It's a lot. So from this facility, it's about like 40 tons per week that's being produced. And across the US, I mean, we estimate that these same kind of fibrous byproducts, there's just billions and billions of pounds that are going to waste every year, that don't have an easy place to kind of plug into the currently established food system.
Why do you think that is? It sounds like, you know, when especially with something like juicing or soybeans, you're doing, I mean, even coffee, other similar products where 90%+ of the weight of the product gets thrown away. Why aren't there other systems to address that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is the linear focus on, you know, how do I get as quickly as possible from my inputs to this one output that I want to be producing. And there really aren't the incentives in place in our food system to think holistically about your inputs. That is something that, you know, traditionally we would do, especially if you're maybe a small producer, or I think a great example is to think about how you treat things at home, right? We look at traditional, usage of okara in East Asia. And there is a pretty rich culinary tradition with it because of the fact that most people would originally make their, you know, back in the day, you would make your soy milk at home. Because you were a lot closer to this concept of waste and, you know, you'd paid for the soybeans that you were using, you used the okara. You saw that as food alongside the soy milk. And I think as we scaled up and our food system became more industrialized, it became more cost effective to just focus on what's the quickest, fastest, cheapest way for me to get my outputs. And that the unintended consequence of that was essentially ignoring anything else that's produced along the way. And so that's exactly where we think these opportunities exist now, is to basically come in and plug in a solution that allows you to make this food production more circular and bring these byproducts back in and being kind of that bridge builder for these products so that we can be more holistic in how we think about the inputs. I think one of the staggering statistics to us was realizing about 60% of the soybeans that come into the facility don't end up, that mass, 60% of that mass doesn't end up in the tofu. So you're going from a situation, you know, before you're utilizing the okara, you have about 40% of the soybean mass that actually ends up as food for people. But when you also are utilizing the byproduct and bringing it back into the food system as, you know, okara flour, now you're utilizing 100% of the soybeans that were grown and made it to the door of the soybean factory, of the tofu factory.
Wow. And Carolyn, tell us a little bit about your story. How did you come to start Renewal Mill?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in the food industry. My parents own an ice cream store named after me, and I grew up working there. So I've always really loved to cook. It's called Sweet Caroline's. It's on Cape Cod in Massachusetts.
That's awesome.
And so just always really been passionate about food, about cooking, and then chose to focus sort of a lot of my studies around the nutrition side of food. So my early career was spent on both working on child obesity under the Obama administration, and then with the UN World Food Program in Cambodia, working on rice fortification, but really seeing firsthand the effects that lack of access to affordable nutrition has on people's health. So when I met Claire and learned about all of this nutrition leaving the food system through sort of just overlooked in the manufacturing and supply chain, it was a really clear fit that we could capture this nutrition and bring it back to people's plates and get that nutrition back to people who need it most.
So let's talk a little bit about how you're using our okara, or how okara has traditionally been used, how you're suggesting people who, you know, who aren't making their own soy milk and tofu on a regular basis might use this ingredient that you're providing to them.
Yeah, so traditionally okara, it's Japanese superfood. So it's actually a Japanese word where O is kind of an honorific and kara means husk. So the whole word kind of means honoring the husk or honoring the whole bean. And it has a ton of fiber in it. So it's traditionally been used as like a side dish in Japanese cuisine. You can saute it with vegetables, but it's a really great way to boost the fiber content of your diet. For us here in the US, we're definitely recommending that people use it as an alternative gluten-free flour. So it has very similar properties when cooking to something like a coconut flour, but with a lot more nutrition. So just a little bit of okara can easily get the fiber and protein content of the final product that you're using it in up to an excellent source of fiber for the day.
Tell me more about some of those traditional uses. What would people have sauteed the sort of husks of the soybeans or ground them up into a flour in the way that you're doing? How do they look different?
Yeah. So in Japan, tofu distribution tofu production is still pretty distributed. So you would have like a local tofu maker in your, you know, village. You could go to them and you would get this wet okara. So when they're making soy milk, they're boiling and blending the beans, they're siphoning off the liquid and then leaving this pulp left over in its wet form. So in Japan, it's traditionally been used in its wet form and sold that way in the grocery store as well. And a fun story is, I don't know if you're familiar with Miyoko's, but they're a vegan cheese company. And Miyoko actually got her start making pound cakes with wet okara in Japan. So lots of applications, both sweet and savory, but definitely a very beloved part of that cuisine.
And in the format that you're working with as a flour, what does it taste like and how does it work in baking kind of standard baked goods like chocolate chip cookies?
Yeah, it's very neutral in flavor and color, which is a huge benefit of Okara. So it looks like traditional all-purpose white flour, and it tastes very similar as well. We're recommending that people either blend it with other gluten-free flours or use it in place of something like a coconut flour. So it's really popular right now with a lot of grain-free bakers or keto-friendly bakers because it's gluten-free, grain-free, and really low in net carbs. So you can have all of those guilty pleasure foods, but without all of the carbs and any calories that come with that.
Yeah. I guess one of the challenges that I've seen a lot of other upcycling companies or companies dealing with food waste kind of in the way that you are is the production costs of turning that food waste into something edible can be pretty high, can be prohibitive. Would you tell us a little more about your production process, what it means, how you take the wet okara from the soy milk and tofu making process and turn it into flour, what that looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was one of our considerations early on was that, you know, we wanted to make this as cost efficient of a process as possible, partly just because that makes it a better business model, but also because, you know, our goal was really to be addressing this particular type of food waste at scale. And to do that, we know we really wanted to be able to price it as you know, mass market as possible so that it could be used in as many places as possible. So it was something we were paying really close attention to. And what we realized was really important was to actually have a co-location model for our production. So we work directly on site with the manufacturers that are producing these byproducts. We place our equipment at their facilities so that we can capture the byproduct and turn it into a shelf-stable ingredient right there on the same factory floor where the byproduct was produced. So that really helps us keep our costs lower because we're not having to ship it anywhere else to like a centralized facility for it to be processed. And it also actually gives us some additional benefits for food safety. So a lot of these byproducts are fairly wet, like the okara. So it's about 80 to 85% moisture coming out of that soy milk making process. And it's prone to spoilage. So it spoils pretty fast. So you really want to make sure that you draw that water content down and dehydrate it very quickly after it's been produced. And so being able to basically just move it directly from the from the soy milk line into the dehydration unit is really critical for that food safety aspect.
And then what happens next?
And then, yeah, so after it's dried, we mill it into a flour. We opted to call it okara flour because it gave a sense of how it could be used. I think in the West, we're more, you know, we're familiar with flour. It has a connotation of, you know, you can think about how it's going to be used. It's also called okara powder, and it can be used actually in kind of the ways that we think of powders being used, you know, a nutrition boost to a smoothie and things like that. But we liked having the word flour there because, I mean, we are milling it to a particle size that's on par with an all-purpose wheat flour. But also it just allows you to kind of think about, okay, the applications where I would be using flour, I can think about how I would be using this upcycled ingredient in those as well. But we can, you know, we can change the milling size and kind of vary the different applications, whether you want something that's better for like a breading, or if you want something that's very, very fine that you might want to try to use in a beverage application. You know, we have some, we can vary that part of the process. And then from there, it can go to a customer who's looking to, you know, purchase this ingredient to use in one of their own products. We use it, you know, we also use it in our own branded product lineup. So, as I mentioned earlier, we have a line of baking mixes and a ready to eat vegan cookie that use the upcycled ingredients. So that's kind of the overview of the production.
Awesome. Let's pause there. Take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 potato chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food. My guests this week are Claire and Carolyn, founders of Renewal Mill in California, making Okara flour from soybean pulp. I know there is a long history of upcycling all kinds of ingredients all around the world, not just in Japan, which we talked about a little bit earlier, but it often has this sense that it's a brand new thing, that these are new ideas that nobody has ever done before. How do you contextualize your work in the bigger picture of both the tradition specifically of Okara, but the bigger picture of upcycling food waste ingredients that takes place, has always taken place all around the world through all of human culinary history?
Yeah, that's very true. You know, it is really a really exciting time for upcycle. There's a lot of momentum behind the word. I think people understand what that concept is. You know, people are beginning to understand what that concept refers to with food and how really it's a signal of a more sustainable food system. It's a signal of being more efficient with our resources, which is, you know, incredibly helpful in helping to fight climate change. So it feels new in the sense that we're kind of naming it something, and we're trying to move our food system to that place. But it is really true that you know, the being efficient with your inputs and the food, the ingredients and the food that you're using to make a meal or make food is definitely not something that's new. And we do, you know, I think it's kind of interesting to think about the food that we eat every day, or food that's very common that you wouldn't necessarily know, but has an upcycled history. I think one of my favorite stories is about the Orida potato factory. When they got started, they I guess they were doing frozen vegetables at first, and they kind of heard about this new craze for French fries, got the equipment in there to basically cut their potatoes to make these frozen French fries. And in the process, of course, you have, you know, waste of the potato that doesn't make the perfect, you know, fry. And this was like back in the 40s, I think. And the brothers that had started this company had lived through the Great Depression. And even though there was kind of a use for it, I think they were maybe kind of like dumping it on fields nearby or something like that, potentially using it for like animal filler feed. They just were really struck by the fact that they could do something more efficient with it. So they kind of put their heads together, did some R&D work, and in the 1950s at the National Potato Convention, I think it was in Florida, they debuted a brand new product, which they called the Tater Tot. And it's just such a kind of beloved food in America. And the origins are very much from thinking about how can we take this potato and not have some of it slip out of our food system as waste, and instead make sure that all of that potato makes it to people, whether it's in the form of a French fry or a tater tot. So there's certainly, you know, there's certainly a rich history to being efficient with food production, which is great. And I think there's just so much opportunity to bring that efficiency, like get that efficiency back. And now we're kind of doing it under this movement that feels new of eating upcycled, but it really has roots, you know, very, very deep roots. And I think it also, you know, I think the concept of upcycled, just because we can tie it so closely to being more sustainable and doing something that's better for the planet, That is also something that feels very urgent right now as well. I mean, it doesn't feel, it is very urgent right now. So there's the right kind of momentum to catalyze our food system to become more efficient.
What are some of go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, yeah, I think, you know, for me, it comes down to the fact like grandma was upcycling, right? Like in the Great Depression, you know, using all of the food that you bought was super important. And so it's kind of hearkening back to that appreciation of food as well. And there's, you know, tater tots is one great example, but there are countless examples of things like hot dogs and whey protein powder and applesauce of really creative things we've done with food that would be considered upcycling. And now we're just bringing it to the forefront again.
Yeah. Are there other ingredients that Renewal Mill is looking at working with beyond Okara?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we are definitely trying to build out a full portfolio of upcycled ingredients. We're starting with the byproducts of plant-based milk, just because we can kind of easily scale our process across them, given how similarly they're produced. So our second ingredient is an oat milk flour made from the pulp left over when you make oat milk, and again, dehydrating it and milling it into a high-protein oat flour. And then there's other plant-based milks we can look at, like almond milk or pea milk and the starch left over from that processing. But yeah, we're also really excited about talking about the potato again. That's one of the largest waste streams in the U.S. is potato peels coming from the French fry process. And so lots of interesting problems to tackle when it comes to building out full ingredient set.
Yeah, I would imagine that marketing upcycled products is a challenge, both because people don't really want to hear that the food that they're eating was somebody's waste, even if it was totally useful, edible, delicious waste. How have you approached that? And do you find that your customers are coming to you because of the social mission that your company has, or because of flavor or nutrition or other reasons?
I think we definitely see both. So ultimately, you know, consumers are still a little bit selfish. They want to know what the product is going to do for them. So nutrition and taste are both very, very important in what we think about as far as bringing on new ingredients. But the sustainability story is great for sort of opening the door, getting that conversation started, and really getting people to double click and understand what purchasing upcycled food means. Because of the challenge with marketing, you know, when we started this, we were really cautious not to put waste anywhere on the package. We didn't want people to think that they were eating food of any sort of lesser quality. But in 2019, we got all of the companies in this space to band together to form the Upcycled Food Association. And we actually just approved the first ever certification standard so that we can have products certified upcycled the way that they're certified organic or certified non-GMO. And we're actually creating a unique seal that will be able to go on the front of these packages to indicate to the consumer that they're certified upcycled, which is really helpful in sort of building a cohesive, centralized message around what it means to purchase upcycled food and what impact that has on the environment, and really take the conversation away from this is waste to this is a climate change prevention method with tangible impacts.
How do you find that people are learning about that? Is it that they come to your site or come across companies like yours and learn about upcycled food through the companies that are making it, or have you seen a bigger media campaign or more sort of general awareness outside that's sending people to you as a result?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a big study that came out by the NRDC about 4 years ago that said 40% of all food produced is wasted. And that statistic, I think, has slowly trickled down so that people are now aware that food waste is an issue. Also, companies like Imperfect Foods have done a really great job of helping educate consumers about all the waste happening at every part of the supply chain, from food left on fields to food being thrown away in restaurants and that sort of thing. So, consumers now know that food waste is an issue, but now they want to know what they can do to help. And that's kind of where upcycled food comes in.
Yep.
So we've been building this story over the last 4 years and really getting it out into the public. But I think this year is really exciting because people like Whole Foods have kind of grasped on and named upcycled food a top 10 trend, which is really, really helpful to bring that into the mainstream so that people are not only aware of food waste, but they know that this is a solution for that problem.
Do you, either of you, have any advice for early stage food entrepreneurs who are thinking about getting into this area, into food waste or upcycled ingredients? How would you recommend they approach it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my first advice is just to say, you know, do it. It's a very exciting time to be in this space. There's a lot of attention that's being turned to it. A lot of people are very there's a lot of passionate people in the space. And I think it's a great time too, because there's a lot of support. Caroline talked about the Upcycled Food Association and how there's a lot of support with all the folks working in this space to uplift this whole new industry of food. I think it's also, you know, so I would encourage you also to utilize the network and utilize the folks that are out there as support to create a business in this space and to utilize byproducts in some way.
And Carolyn?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just, there's so much opportunity for someone who wants to be creative. I think some of the best chefs are the people that kind of think outside the box and, you know, you like kind of like Chopped, right? You're using things that might not be in the mainstream, but you can create super unique products that are really intriguing to sort of millennial and Gen Z consumers. So if you have an idea, like Claire said, just hop in. And then if you definitely want to create an upcycled product, there are more and more companies that are offering different ingredients. And so it's getting easier and easier to source almost entirely upcycled ingredients for your final product and then be able to market that, certify your product, and get that out into the mainstream.
Yeah, awesome. All right. So just do it. If you're thinking about it, just do it. Let's do a little fun question segment before we wrap up the interview. We're coming up on the end. Claire, why don't you get us started? If you were a vegetable, what vegetable would you be?
I think I would be a green bean because I like the ones that climb. I think it's I like the idea of I like the idea of kind of being over the garden, looking. You know, kind of swaying in the breeze, looking over the garden.
You're the first person who's ever answered that question with a description really? Of the plant that the vegetable grows on. Everybody else is, you know, I'm an eggplant, I'm an onion, I'm a whatever. No,
but, oh, that's so
but
funny.
You're the only one
yeah,
who describes
no,
the plant.
I'm thinking, I'm like literally that green bean. Okay, yes.
I love it. Carolyn, how about you?
I think I'd be a sweet potato. You know, you can go sweet, you can go savory, not a little bit hard to pin down, but always surprising.
Very flexible. Sounds good. What is the best meal that you ever had that cost less than $5 or $10? Claire, you want to go first?
Sure. This is actually an easy one for me. Vegan street tacos in Mexico City. Amazing. There's like multiple places to get them and just incredible. So many different flavors and interesting concepts in those tacos.
What kinds of vegan ingredients?
Oh, I can't even like remember them all, but you know, just basically any kind of vegetable that you can think of that was in there.
Awesome. Carolyn?
Tacos is a good one, but I used to live in Taiwan. In southern Taiwan, there was a man that sold only scallion pancakes out of his truck outside of the Costco. And there would be always a line like, you know, 40 people long for these massive scallion pancakes that just melt in your mouth. They're absolutely delicious.
Sounds amazing. How about childhood breakfasts? Claire, what was your favorite breakfast as a kid? Or what did you eat on a sort of a regular breakfast on a school day morning or something?
Oh, good question. My first answer that I was thinking about is like, of course, my dad's pancake breakfast, but that was a special Sunday morning only. My more regular breakfast, I was a cereal kid. It was a lot of cereals. My mom had two rules. It couldn't have artificial preservatives in it and sugar could not be the first ingredient, but otherwise we could choose a cereal of our choice. It was somewhat limiting from the eyes of an 8-year-old child in the cereal aisle.
Sugar but, not being the first ingredient.
Right. It's much easier to follow those rules now, but, back when I was a child, it was like, you know, all the good ones were didn't fit that, yeah. But yes.
And Carolyn, how about you?
My mom was also not a cereal person, but there was no rules. There was just no cereal, so definitely we were more of an eggs breakfast, scrambled eggs.
Did you ever get to have ice cream for breakfast, or was that off limits?
No, I feel like once you've seen so much ice cream, you definitely lose an appetite for it. So, when given the choice, ice cream is not even in my top 10 desserts.
Yeah. All right, last question. Desert island kitchen tool. What do you bring with you if you can only bring one thing to your desert island?
Oh, boy. One kitchen tool. Okay, I'm so hard.
Okay, I know this one.
Okay, go.
For me, my favorite kitchen tool is the I have a mini food processor, and I make everything in that, from salad dressings to, like, chocolate mousse to hummus, you name it. It's in my mini food processor.
Awesome.
I think I'm going to have to go with a garlic press, because I put garlic in basically everything. And it's, I mean, I use that garlic press all the time. I'm not sure how useful it would be on a desert island. Yeah. I'm assuming that there's garlic there and some ways to enjoy it. But yeah, that's probably my most used kitchen item.
Yeah, I think you could have garlic on a desert island for sure. Okay. Why go to a desert island without any garlic? Where can our listeners find you, follow your work, follow you on social media, purchase your products?
Yes, you can find us pretty much everywhere at Renewal Mill, and we are online at renewalmill.com. You can also find our products on Thrive Market, on Amazon. We will be launching soon on Fresh Direct. So there's some other places online that you can find us other than the website as well.
Awesome.
And then we're in brick and mortar stores, mostly in California, but coming to your neighborhood soon.
Awesome. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. Thanks to Armin Spengen, our amazing sound engineer. As always, you can reach us by email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org, or on social at yfoodpodcast. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram. And you can reach Valerie on Instagram, at foodie in New York. And most of all, Claire, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me. This has been such a great conversation and great to catch up.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Ethan. Really appreciate it.
Talk to you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.